Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
From Los Angeles, I'm Justin Savakis.
And I'm Zach Birch. Welcome to AnCast. This is our 50th show. Hooray.
Woo-hoo.
Are you out of party poppers?
I have another one. You want me to grab another? Hold on. Yeah. There we go. My neighbors are going to think I'm getting shot.
The lamest celebration of all time.
No, those are whippersnappers.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. So this is our 50th show, and here's to 50 more, I think, if we can fill 50 more shows. But there's lots to talk about this week. Some news, some bad news, mostly bad news.
Almost all bad news, actually.
Well, when is it not bad news in the anime industry? So what's been going on?
This week we learned about the untimely demise of two anime studios, one of which is actually very near and dear to my heart, Group Tech. And Group Tech has been around for ages. They're the studio affiliated with Gisaburo Sugi, who's one of the old anime stalwarts.
What did he do?
This is the studio that gave us Touch and Night on Galactic Railroad and almost all of the Street Fighter 2 anime, including the actually decent movie.
Oh, well, that's a shame. But then again, when's the last time they made anything?
It's been a few years. Apparently, the actual CEO of the company passed away a couple years ago, and they were already kind of in dangerous waters, as every anime studio is these days. And without his leadership, they just weren't able to survive. They ended up racking up millions of dollars in debt, and they finally succumbed. I think they filed for bankruptcy last day in August.
Interesting. Well, that's a shame, and then they're not the only ones, right?
And the other one is Office AO or Office OW. I really hope it's Office OW because it'd be kind of funny. They were mostly an in-betweener studio. They didn't really plan any of their own anime, but they'd been around a while, and so that was kind of a bummer too. This isn't really the first time we've seen a bunch of anime studios go under. And this, by the way, I don't think this is the last of it. There's a lot of sick anime studios out there.
Right.
But the last time this happened was when the bubble economy burst it took a couple years after that. So probably 91, 92, that's when a bunch of them really started going under. And how the industry pulled itself out from that point was it found money. That's really when we started seeing the rise of the production committee system, the Seisaku Inkai system, mm-hmm. where like all the different possible sponsors all throw money at it and split the rights between them.
Yeah.
Which makes the business of it just an absolute nightmare. But it was done out of necessity because that was the only way to raise enough funds to keep making new productions. Well, a lot of the companies that were participating in that Seisaku Inkai system, with the cratering of the economy around the world, in Japan in particular, is in a horrible state. A lot of those companies just don't have the kind of funds to throw at anime anymore, or anything. So the circle of money, I mean, people are always happy to blame piracy for this. This goes way beyond piracy. These are really endemic problems. It used to be that the TV networks would be a big part of the production committee, but they're all suffering right now. TV Tokyo, I think, lost money for the first time ever last quarter.
Wow. Things are shit. It's a shit economy. I mean, all around the world, it's a shit economy.
And especially in entertainment. There is nobody wants to invest in entertainment right now. And so there's just not a whole lot of money, stupid or otherwise, being tossed into the production pile. So there's less work. And so the companies that make stuff are starting to shrivel up and die.
In other words, we're on the downside of a cycle.
Right. And this happens. Yeah. And honestly, this should happen. There were probably There's we've known for a while and that there is just too much anime being made, and this is just part of that. And, you know, over the past 10 years, 15 years, there have been a lot of new little anime companies starting up, and not all of them can survive. So, you know.
It's the market.
The weak get killed. That's the business world.
Yeah. Nothing like economic Darwinism.
Seriously.
So before we get to sort of what we've been watching, which is, that's going to be a big segment this week.
Right.
Right now we're doing our retrospective on Satoshi Kon, which I'm really happy with. It's been going great this week. But I got a question from somebody, and this sort of came up. He wanted to know, because in the forums there have been the sort of expected but still kind of really sort of reactions of like, hey guys, he wasn't that great. And so like they have to be contrarian about it. And it's fine if you didn't think he was great or didn't really like his movies that much. But a celebratory retrospective is not the place to walk in and start talking about that. It's just kind of, you know, basic social niceties. But I guess this is the internet. But somebody was asking, he wanted to know what's with all the negative reactions to the Kon articles. He doesn't understand why they would criticize his works in there. And I have to say, I've been, I moderate the crap out of our forums. It's part of my job. And the response to the Kon articles has been overwhelmingly positive. It's 99% positive, and then you get one guy coming in making a negative comment, and then everyone starts paying attention to that guy. I just want to say, like, if your perception of a discussion is based only on the negative comments, that's what you're going to see. And it's important to look at the positive comments. I mean, reading those talkbacks, it's great. People love those articles, and they're celebrating his work.
It is so uplifting to me.
Yeah.
I mean, my Millennium Actress article just went up last night when we're recording this. And, God, just it just feeds the soul when after you write something and, you know, everyone's just commenting on the film because it's just a favorite among so many people.
Yeah, it's a positive thing. And I just think in general, like culturally, we have a tendency to focus only on the negative things that people say. And I don't, you know, these people aren't necessarily trolling. I think some of them are, but you know, just ignore the guy that comes in and tries to be a bummer. You know, just ignore that guy. Focus on the positive stuff. That's sort of my public service announcement. The forums are not a negative place 99% of the time. If you actually look at the quality of comments, most people are pretty upbeat. So let's just have a little perspective. But anyway, those Kon articles will run through Saturday. Mike's Tools final installment will be on Paprika.
I can't wait for that.
On Saturday. This is going to be sort of a weekend of Mike Tool because he's got his column on Saturday and then his regular Mike Tool show is up on Sunday. So if you're a fan of Tool, check out ANN this weekend. So you had something new.
Yeah, there's I have a licensing announcement for the streaming side of the site. We have actually gone back and license rescued animation runner Kuromi-chan.
Now, I don't think I think I've only seen like one part of that. Aren't there two of those?
Yeah, there's two OAVs. The first one's like 35 minutes. The other one's 45. And they're directed by Akitaro Daichi. The guy did Kodocha, Fruits Basket, a bunch of stuff. And so it's, you know, really kind of spastic humor. But it fit really well with Anime News Network because it's about how difficult and ridiculous it is to make an anime. And how the people that are behind it just pretty much work themselves into the ground to do it. But it's all very lighthearted and very funny. And Akitaro Daichi is one of the few anime comedy directors whose work almost always clicks with me.
Yeah.
So we're really happy to have him. We did get the CPM dub. We actually, I have to thank my old boss, John O'Donnell, for clearing up the rights situation with that dub.
Right.
So, yeah, we'll have both of them subbed and dubbed. I'm waiting for a feature on the site to be finished, but hopefully we can get that up in the next few weeks.
Cool. Actually, speaking of Daichi, I noticed you posted Girl Power.
A lesser work.
Yeah, well, no, I wanted to remind people, like, if they don't remember, that was, like, the first attempt at a simultaneous Region 1, Region 2 release, and man, did it flop. The thing just fell on its face. It was one DVD. It was a half-hour OVA. That was ADV's big push for simultaneous releases, so there's no fan sub problem anymore. And it
was really cute. but
it's not a quality judgment on the show. It was just that was sort of a weird time when people were starting to realize, hey, fan subs are really cutting into our sales.
Yeah,
or at least that's when they started blaming piracy.
You could almost I remember that moment just kind of feeling like I was at the top of the first hill of a roller coaster.
Yeah,
and just going, uh oh,
right, memories. So we've both been watching a ton of shit. Before we get into anime, I did briefly want to mention I spent Labor Day weekend watching Breaking Bad. I marathoned season 2 and 3, which was a bad idea.
Oh my god!
I mean, I was gripped by it because that show is amazing. But good lord, it's a downer. Like it got to a point where I was laughing because it was just like, what horrible thing is going to happen to these people next? Like, what ridiculously horrible thing is going to happen? It's an amazing show, and if people have the stomach for pretty brutal events, it's amazing character work, amazing writing. Man, I was just in love with it. I should not have marathoned it because my whole weekend was just a series of bummers. But so anime wise, you got to a bunch of stuff and I got to at least one thing. So what did you wind up getting to?
I did. I actually revisited two old classics. The one that I'd seen ages ago but hadn't seen in forever was Nadesco.
Yeah, that thing still holds up.
It really holds up. In fact, I was actually impressed and somewhat taken aback by how smart it is.
Yeah, it's a really smart satire. It's I wouldn't call it parody. I would call it satire.
Yeah, definitely. It passes into satire. Now, if you ask me, this is how you make satire about otaku. One thing that really left me cold about a lot of recent otaku parodies, Genshiken among them, is that it's basically just a mirror.
Yeah.
And, you know, even the best of them, Welcome to the NHK, that, although it kind of was making a very perceptive statement, it wasn't really taking the idea of an otaku and juxtaposing it on anything else.
Right.
Nadesco was really kind of something far removed. It's almost, I'd almost equate it to Rogen Z as far as how it just takes various normal otaku tropes or normal anime tropes and just does something really creative on them, puts a really creative spin on them.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being most impressed by that show being really, really funny, really, really sharp, and the editing and pacing was really well done.
Yeah,
like the episodes just zoom past, at least in the first half. I really have no memory of the second half of that show.
The second half gets bogged down a little bit in its own politics. It gets a little too smart for its own good, but it's Sho Aikawa. Of course it does.
It also kind of stops focusing on the humor, right? It gets pretty serious.
Yeah, it does. I mean, there are still humorous moments, and I like to pretend that the final movie just doesn't exist.
That movie was terrible.
Yeah,
it
ended up being like all kind of Ruri fan service.
Ruri fan service and super serious, and the plot was just all over the fucking place. It's like they took everything that I liked about that show out of it for the movie.
Right.
But the show is a classic, and I should revisit that myself sometime soon.
You know, I have to give credit where credit's due here. I give a lot of Matt Greenfield dubs a lot of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of them are really, really heinous.
Right.
But this is probably his finest hour. This I really prefer Nadesco dubbed.
Really?
Yeah. The thing about it is he always did really kind of manic, energetic humor very well because a lot of his style involved everyone screaming.
Right.
And that really, really worked for Nadesco. Everyone's kind of on edge, but in a comedic manner, and it works dramatically.
Interesting. I only ever saw that. I mean, my first exposure to that show were the fan sub tapes from the 90s.
Oh, me too.
And so every time I've revisited it, I just never bothered with the dub. Pretty much, if I watched it first subbed, I'm going to keep watching it. So
the name pronunciations might grate because they didn't get the right syllable pronunciation, so Eureka becomes Eureka and Akito becomes Akito. which is a little weird. But aside from that, yeah, that's an easy thing to get over.
I remember it being the hugest deal because that's one of those shows I watched week to week at my anime club in college. And I remember when they killed off Guy, the room just like exploded. That's such a great moment, though, because the director is so fucking with the audience.
Right.
He's clearly supposed to be your favorite character, and they just kill him right off.
Did you ever read the manga?
No. I heard it was bad.
It's horrendous. It's not funny at all. They completely rewrote the crap out of this show. I don't even think Guy was in it.
Yeah, probably not. I heard a lot of bad things about it, so I never touched it.
Well, that's the thing. It's Kiya Asamiya, and he's I don't care what anyone says. He is fucking terrible.
Yeah, he's a hack. I hate that guy. I hate his work anyway. I've never met the man, but his work is right. His work drives me nuts.
I tried, we published a lot of it when I was at CPM, so I would always, I worked right across the way in the big bullpen from the manga guys, so I would occasionally just wander over the 10 feet and see the Kiya Asamiya stuff on the shelf while something was running. I'm like, I'll flip through it. I never got more than 5 pages into any of them. They were utterly incomprehensible. I couldn't tell who was talking, what was going on. Awful, awful, awful. Anyway, yeah. Second thing I got to, which I cannot believe I hadn't seen yet, was Wolf's Rain.
I'm gonna go ahead and go out on a limb, and if it wasn't a burnout phase, you got all this shit talking before you actually watched the show. In terms of why you didn't get to it,
right? Yeah, from the sounds of it, almost everyone that hates it was burned by the 4 episodes of mismanagement and SARS scare. Recap episode.
Right. Yeah, I understand. There was a lot of shit talking about that show, though. I think it was because at the time that, when it came out, there was sort of Bishonen fatigue. And that show is all Bishonen for the most part. And I don't know. It's just people were really down on that show, especially after the first like 5 episodes. I loved that show. Loved it. And you did too, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, I'm only 4 episodes in, but I'm rolling it. I'm rolling it like a pig in shit.
Right.
What's kind of funny is, two small stupid observations. The first is that one guy with the sunglasses and the buzz cut.
Yeah.
I can't stop thinking of M.D. Geist.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's a good point.
It's not ruining it for me, but sometimes it comes dangerously close. All I can think of is like, okay, guy with bad haircut and sunglasses, in leather atop a motorcycle being badass. Uh-oh. This is not a good sign.
That and the lead character bears and once you notice it, you can't not notice it. He looks like Adrian Grenier.
God damn it, Zach.
He totally does. Same exact haircut.
Well, one thing that's killing me is the young character, the kid.
Yeah.
Blanking on his name. Why does he wear his hair in a bob?
I don't know, but
he looks like Mary Tyler Moore circa 1964.
I guess so. I don't know. I like that character design for some reason. I like the way that kid looked. I thought it was
nice. He's cute, but
Yeah. I don't know. That show, though, it's really well done, sort of psychological fantasy. It's post-apocalyptic, and it's just very well done. I love the ending to that show. A lot of people bitched about the ending. It's one of those, or is it, sort of endings, but it's really good.
I'm also digging the Yoko Kanno at her creative peak.
Yeah.
Score.
Man, music's great.
Yeah. She's I couldn't help but notice that her output lately has ground to a halt, and it kind of coincided with her divorce.
Yeah. Well, artists.
So, yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm hardly going to fault her for that, but man, I just all the memories of these soundtracks and now actually seeing it, it's nice that one show actually holds up when compared to the soundtrack.
Yeah, actually, I think, Cowboy Bebop aside, I think that and the Escaflowne movie are pretty much her two best pieces, her best soundtracks, I guess.
I think my favorite of her soundtrack is still Brain Powered.
Unfortunately, that show.
Train wreck. I saw a few episodes of that show. I was actually getting mad because it was wasting that amazing soundtrack.
It's such a terrible fucking show. God.
Yes.
So
they couldn't even spell powered right.
Speaking of decent fantasy, the thing that I surprisingly had a really positive reaction to, I was digging through my closet and I found I hit a vein of some old anime DVDs. I found like my copy of the original DigiCarrot show, which I still enjoy. It's still funny. That was one of the few shows where it really coincided with my sense of humor.
Well, it's really dark and aggressive, surprisingly.
It is. So. Yeah, it's yeah, totally. But beneath that was my copy of Vampire Hunter D: Bloodlust, which I have not seen since it came out. And I remember being disappointed in it when I first saw it. And this was, let's say, 8 years ago, I think. Is that movie really 8 years old? When I first saw it, I was let down by it because I was expecting a Hammer horror gothic all vampire type of thing, because I guess I at the time I didn't understand that Vampire Hunter D is basically sci-fi fantasy. Upon rewatching it, I loved it. Like, the plot's kind of a mess, but that's not really what it's for. It's there to look at, and it's an amazing piece of it. The animation's gorgeous. And I love the way that they just kind of throw in all these sort of 1980s style sci-fi fantasy, imagery, just sort of lumping it all in. It's kind of like whatever they can come up with, they threw into this movie. And it's super fun to watch.
I love that movie.
Yeah, it's really good. Like, it's kind of like, I haven't seen it in so long. The animation is just spectacular. Like, God, I wish people had this kind of budget now, but it reminded me of, like, those old, 1980s VHS cover illustrations where the cover illustration was way more fantastical than the movie was?
Right. Like what they tried to do with Warriors of the Wind.
Yeah, exactly. This is kind of like if the movie advertised on the cover was actually the movie. It's just a moving VHS cover. I just love it. It reminds me so much of the aesthetic of that era. And I hope... Does this thing have a Blu-ray in Japan?
No.
Yeah, well, it should. Somebody, and considering Urban Vision just yanked all their titles from solicitation, if you can track down a copy, and please somebody put it out on Blu-ray, because I want the Blu-ray.
Oh, I should ask Rona what's up. The story behind Vampire Hunter D: Bloodlust that I heard, now this is just rumor, we should get Rona on the show at some point, but what basically happened was they were expecting to sell this as a finished product to a big major US studio and then redub it.
Oh, right.
Actual,
yeah.
Hollywood voice talent.
It's a temp dub, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a temp dub, and that just never happened. So they just had to release it as is.
Did the version with the Japanese ever actually get released?
Not here, but in Japan.
Yeah, well, that's I meant here, because right. I at the time, like in 2004, it was 2005. Urban Vision was still around. They were trying to sell some of their crappy live action stuff, and I was working at Anime Insider at the time, and I kept asking them, like, "Hey, when are you going to put out a Vampire Hunter D with the Japanese track?" Because the dub is pretty crappy, and I always
it's not great.
The lip flaps are not specific, so you could easily watch it in either language. It's not going to be distracting.
Right.
And they said, we're going to put out a big 2-disc special edition. They actually had packaging mock-ups for it and everything, but it just never showed up.
Yikes. I'm pretty sure that they were actually part of the production committee on Vampire Hunter D: Bloodlust. I'm pretty sure almost everyone involved ended up losing money on it. Because, if it was made with the expectation that they were going to sell it to Hollywood studio, I can only see that ending in disappointment for everyone.
Yeah, I don't know, though. Like, it's such a trippy thing to watch. I'm surprised it didn't get snapped up. I mean, if you think, like, sort of a cliche of what anime is, that movie certainly falls into that category. And it delivers on its promise. Like, right. It really delivers. It's everything you would want from a movie called Bloodlust.
As opposed to, say, Highlander the Animated Movie.
Oh, my God. Yoshiaki Kawajiri, great animation, hideous character designs. Like, the girl in Bloodlust, warrior chick, she is so ugly. It's such an unattractive character design.
What's with that bizarre, almost dandelion hair?
Yeah. She's hideous, but really well animated. All right, well, happy 50th show, and let's go ahead and get to the guest.
Yep. Nerd!
Okay, we're back. My guests today are from the sort of plucky upstart company Anime Midstream, which is currently handling the title Raijin O. Joining us is executive producer Jimmy Taylor and the localization expert and sort of voice actress in the show, Kat Thompson. Hi, guys. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Hello. Thanks for having us on.
Sure thing.
Same here.
So the biggest question is, who are you and what are you doing? I think you're very new to the scene, and our listeners are surely curious because you guys came out of nowhere. So what happened? How'd you get your start?
Well, originally we've actually been an idea that was going around since probably about 2005, me and a few others. Pretty much we just didn't know really how to start. You know, we were toying around with it and stuff. And then I was invited to one of the conventions in St. Louis, Anime STL. Of 2008, and we went there and we were like having a great time and stuff. And then after that, we kind of went back home because we were kind of like looking at some of the fans, and we kind of noticed that there was kind of like a, I guess the way the anime industry is, there's kind of just a straight trend. There's just showing kind of certain shows or a genre, and we thought, you know, it'd be great to go back to something, you know, old, something fun. You know, it doesn't have to be serious or anything, just something fun. So after that, we went back and we sat down and we finally decided, let's do it. We have the people, we have the knowledge. You know, some of us have worked in the industry for a while. So we pretty much pulled together and then we just started trying to figure out what to do. And that's how actually the company was originally just started.
Okay. And so how did you even approach licensing this show? I'm very curious. Justin's sort of an expert on licensing stuff. And I mean, I have no idea how somebody just decides I'm going to license an anime. Where did you get the contact information? What was that process like?
Oh, yeah, that was interesting. We're sitting there. We were sitting at the table and we're just like thinking, oh, we'd love to license this and license that. And we're just like, just looking up shows, you know, just kind of brainstorming, not really thinking about it. And then we were like, okay, let's do it. But again, we don't know what shows were licensed. So what we did, we just started contacting companies. Like we called or emailed almost every Japanese licensor you could think of, whether it be American or in Japan. And a lot of them got back to us. Some of them, I guess, kind of just might have passed over because they thought, you know, just out of nowhere someone emails you. But a lot of them did get back to us, and they said, you know, we're interested. So they sent us, you know, catalogs and things of what they had. And, of course, the catalogs also have things that were licensable. But we pretty much just asked, and they were happy to just give us things to look at, mostly.
And what was that negotiation process like? Were they – I mean, I can't imagine they were asking for a huge amount of money.
Oh, for Raijin O?
Yeah.
Well, also when we got Raijin O, it was also kind of Raijin O was just kind of just – it was great to get because we had a list of all the titles like from Sunrise that we went back to, and they gave us pretty much what were available and what weren't. And myself, I've never seen Raijin O. I didn't know anything about it except through the video games. And I pretty much said, well, how about this one? And then we talked with the Japanese people, which and then were pretty much, okay, we might be able to do something. And they pretty much just gave us all the information. And then after that – we spent anywhere from like 3 to 4 months just negotiating the contract alone.
So you mentioned that you had people on staff that worked in the industry for a while. What did they do? Did they? I mean, obviously that expertise came in handy.
Yeah, a lot of it's mostly just pretty much being part of productions, such as most of them are just voice actors in general. Like myself, I've been doing voiceovers for 10 years. I've also been in a couple anime as well that were produced by other companies. And then some of the other people that are in the cast as well as some of the staff are also people that have either worked as in like video game dubs and stuff. So they're very familiar with the process that goes on in the studio, and we pretty much just applied it to ourselves as well.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. So in terms of the localization, it sounds like this project is sort of born out of a desire to localize and dub something rather than, you know, just straight up licensing the show and getting it out there. You are really wanting to dub it, which is becoming an uncommon practice in the anime industry.
Yeah, it's pretty much you see a lot of things that are coming, especially that are old or more subtitled than dubbed. They just release it subtitled, and that's how it is, which is fine. But we wanted to kind of bring back that old feeling from, you know, back in the 80s and 90s when it was just getting new, and the shows were really fun and just, you know, you had like the Monster of the Day, things like that, just a really, really fun show. And we wanted to do something different pretty much from what everyone else is doing.
Right. Okay. Have you been approached by any of the other companies that still exist, you know, in terms of distribution or bringing any of you on board or anything like that?
Actually, no. That's kind of one of the problems that we were having is the distribution process, because it's like we contact people, but since we're new, you know, I guess people don't want to take a chance on a new company. But eventually, you know, we were contacted by, you know, Right Stuff. And they were, you know, Sean from Right Stuff was so quick to help us, and he was really good, and he got our product out there before anyone else even got a chance to get a hold of it.
Right, right.
I was just going to say it's got to be really hard to get any stores to stock stuff these days, especially an obscure 80s mecha show.
Yeah, it is, because even now if you go to the stores, if you notice, the anime shelves are getting a little bare, because I think a lot of it is going to online retailers now.
Well, yeah, they're, I mean, Best Buy shrank their anime space by something like 80%. It's still there, but it's a tiny little section. So, I mean, but being realistic, the online retail space is the best place for your product. I mean, it's a very obscure show. It appeals to a very specific kind of fan. What kind of fan feedback have you been getting?
It's kind of mixed, really. We have the mech fans that are, I guess, the big mech fans are really happy that we just brought it over, because it was never ever brought over, and they're happy to see it, and they're happy that, you know, we put it out. We subtitled it, and some people like the dub. Some people don't like the dub. You know, it's always a give and take.
Yeah.
But most of the time I get comments about is when we dubbed it is they just think that we should have been more over the top with it, you know, just crazy with it.
Really?
And yeah, a lot of people keep telling me that they thought everyone could have more emotion, like the main character, Jen. She doesn't scream as much as she should, the actress that does her. And we kind of toned it back because of that. But also the thing is, well, people don't understand that when a lot of people start doing this, everyone's just learning their role. They don't know how the character acts. All they have are the Japanese to go on. And we do our best to kind of copy that in a sense. We use their inflections and how they act. And I tell my actors that I want to reflect that in the dub because I want it to be close to being original as possible, which was kind of what our contract was about. We promised to keep the show as original as possible without changing hardly anything.
So I guess that's a good question for Kat. What is your approach in terms of localizing? Because it sounds like you're pretty strict in terms of sticking to the original script. Is there any temptation to veer off?
We do veer off a little bit, and it's only on like an occasional line here and there. Otherwise, we try and stay as close to the original Japanese as we can, which, of course, is a difficult thing because their sense of humor, our sense of humor are completely different. And there's a lot of stuff, of course, that just doesn't translate over. So it's a bit of a process to keep it as similar as humanly possible and still get that same sense of humor and get the same impact that it has in the Japanese and transfer over that to the English.
Right, right. So have you guys seen some of the really like heavily localized reversion dubs that like Funimation has done on like Sergeant Frog or like a Shin-chan, where they completely rewrite it and turn it into basically a different sort of comedy, sort of a Western comedy? Have you seen those, and what's your reaction to that, and were you at all tempted to take that path with this?
Kat, would that be better for you to answer? Because I don't think I've seen any of those.
I haven't really seen any anything that was just completely changed. I've seen stuff with dub titles, which are pretty annoying to look at, but it was never something that we ever thought about doing because, like Jimmy said, it was part of our agreement that we were going to keep it as original as possible.
Now, a lot of shows from this era and earlier, this is kind of on the end of this era, are kind of notorious for their materials being a mess. Like, sometimes the M&E tracks are on old, unsynced reel-to-reel. What did you have to work with when you got the stuff?
Oh, when I got the stuff, pretty much all I was given was pretty much the footage. You know, I was given the video, and I was given the, I know the first volume, I was given the tracks. All the tracks were mono. Every track was. And I did my best to try to like make that work with the DVD. Like I tried doubling it up. It would not work because we couldn't get it to switch channels to save our lives. So I had to balance the track, and sometimes it goes back and forth, but that was to balance it out. And as far as materials is making the things, I was pretty much sent pretty much like a package with all the artwork and stuff. And the artwork, since it was so old, was on 35 millimeter slides.
Ooh, those things are heinous.
Yeah, so I had to pretty much get equipment to scan these things. So I got the equipment and scanned these things. And when you look at them, you can tell that they've probably been in a vault somewhere because, you know, they have water damage on them a little bit and stuff like that, and they have all this stuff on them. And we had to clean that up. And pretty much we started using that for promos when we'd be handing out things at conventions and stuff. But, like, I guess next would be, like, where the covers come from for the DVDs. Those, the covers that we're making are pretty much being almost designed from scratch.
That's interesting. So what kind of a staff do you have? Do you have someone whose job is just that? It sounds like Kat wears a lot of different hats there. Like, what? How do you have an office? What's your infrastructure like?
Oh, well, pretty much we have, like, everyone kind of does, like, four or five jobs a piece because we're very small and, you know, it helps keep the costs down when right. working on the show. And stuff, because we kind of really don't have a time schedule as far as like office hours. We all work together. When we get it done, we get it done as soon as possible. But like, yeah, I have a guy dedicated to just nothing but graphics. It's what he does. He does the graphics stuff. He also does all the graphics for our website. That's his job. That's what he does. And then like the marketing person, like I have my marketing director, Gil Santiago, who does our marketing for us. She does all the emails. She takes care of everything. She talks to all the online distributors and stuff, handles that. And she pretty much does that, and she also gets all the orders ready as well. So she kind of does inventory as well as do the marketing as well.
So it's a real sort of a mom-and-pop operation. It's,
you could say that. Yeah, there's a small group of us, but we're all really, you know, tight-knit. We're all able to get a hold of each other. It's not like someone just disappears. You know, when it's time to work, you know, we're right there. We're ready to go.
Right, right. So in terms of casting, now, I don't know what the talent pool is like in St. Louis, but did you hold auditions? Did you get a lot of people showing up? Were you basically just casting, you know, friends and family? Because it sounds like you have a sort of a clique of voice actors there.
St. Louis actually has a very big talent when it comes to actors and models and stuff. Not many people know that, but there's a very big pull here in St. Louis. And what we did, we kind of held open auditions is what we did, which is not uncommon for most companies to do. I think it was an anime convention, Anime STL 2009, I believe. That spring, we held open auditions at the convention itself. So we were like, you know, the actors want to come in, that's fine. And I don't know how many anime fans usually always ask the question, you know, what's it take to be a voice actor? So we even opened it up to them as well. And we had a very good turnout. I mean, we had over 100 people audition just in the 2 days we did it.
Yeah, I can imagine the
that must have been a whole lot of fun to sort through.
It was very interesting, yeah. Cuz we did, cuz I, you know, I brought, you know, like, you know, pretty much portable equipment to the convention, and we got a room, and we eventually brought people in one by one and stuff. And the thing is, though, the auditions, so many people showed up that we actually had to vacate the room for it to be used for its next function, and then we got the room afterwards to continue because more people showed up than what was really anticipated.
Well, that is the dream of, seems like, 85% of anime con attendees to be a voice actor.
Kat, are you laughing over there?
Yes, I am. I'm just remembering how that went. Oh my gosh.
Any stories?
It was pretty chaotic at the convention. Just so many people. And it was pretty entertaining because a lot of them were very intimidated by the idea of coming in and doing a live audition. I mean, we offered people, yeah, you can turn in demo reels and demo CDs and all that stuff. But if you want to audition just at con in front of us, and we allowed that, and people got so nervous.
Did you actually wind up hiring anybody from that pool of people?
Actually, we did. We did. We hired I'd say 3/4 of our cast did come from that convention, because a lot of them that did come in, actually, they actually have, you know, some experience, you know, acting and stuff. So a lot of them didn't come in, didn't have any experience. A lot of them did have experience. And we hired like our main actress that plays Jen. We found her there. And I think the top three boys that are the show, all three of them came from that convention, because they came in and they just blew me and my marketing director away when they just performed for us in front of the mic. It was amazing.
Interesting. I think if you that would be a total mob scene if you did it at a really big convention like an Otakon or an Anime Expo. I can't even imagine what that would be like. Speaking of those, it sounds like you guys really enjoy the con scene. Do you get out to any other conventions, or you just do your local one?
Well, we do the local one, Anime St. Louis, which is our home convention. We make sure we're going to do that one as much as we can. We try to get around. I mean, we didn't make ASIN this year because of production schedules. We were planning on going. We didn't. We just the last one we got done doing was Tokyo and Tulsa. We were down there for a weekend. We might have a con coming up in November. I think it's called YuleCon. We might be going to that one. And I think that's how it is for the end of the year. But next year, you know, if cons want us, we're happy to come. You know, we email cons and cons email us. And if we don't show, we do send screeners to all the cons because all the cons ask for DVDs from us.
Right. Interesting. Okay. So let's talk about this show a little bit. It's sort of an eccentric pick. Did you have a background in mecha shows? Was that something that you were just personally interested in? Were you drawn to this title for that reason? You know, what's your background like on that one?
Oh, just picking the show was kind of like – it was kind of luck pretty much because we had a list of shows we gave Sunrise that we were interested in, and they just let us know what was available. And out of the shows that were available, this one kind of stuck out because I've never seen it, and I was actually able to get a hold of some of the footage, and I sat down and watched it. And, you know, I was laughing, having fun with it, and the people that were with me having fun with it. So we were like, you know what? This might be fun. So that's kind of how we did it. And besides myself, what I've been with, you know, I grew up watching shows like, you know, the old 80s stuff, like the original G1 Transformers, the old Gundam stuff. You know, that's the stuff I grew up watching, you know, Go Lion, Robotech, Macross, things like that.
Right.
That kind of had an influence, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, now this is the first in this, isn't it? I mean, the history of this particular show, Justin, I think you might be a little bit more familiar with it than I am. But it's
barely.
It's the first in a long series of giant robot shows, right?
Yeah, it's the first of, I believe, four, actually. But the fourth one I don't think was ever done. But yeah, it's one of three. It's the first show. I'm trying to remember the names of the other two, the Eldoron series. Like, I think the first one, which, of course, is Raijano. The second after that, I think, is called Gomberger. And the third one is called, I think, Ghost Saucer, if I remember correctly.
And any plans on, you know, snapping those up once you're finished with this one?
We're kind of working on this one. I haven't really thought about it. But I think that once we're done with this one, we've been kind of, not officially, but it's almost like if we want to do them, they will probably be offered to us.
Interesting.
It's 51 episodes, and obviously that's going to take you guys quite a while to get through.
Yeah, our production schedule has been slow. But, of course, the first volume took so long because, it took months to get through, you know, over 200 auditions. We wanted to at least get through them all, give everyone a chance. And the fact we had to redesign, you know, everything from scratch as well, which took a while. And the recording process, I think, took 2 to 3 months to get it all done.
Now, I mean, I would imagine that you sort of got over your learning curve in that time, and is your production schedule faster now?
Yeah, it's a little bit faster. Like, this time around, we were kind of had to slow down a bit because we were starting to do the con scene more, so we weren't in the production thing as long. Also, the fact a lot of the actors are back in school now as well. You know, I mean, over the summer, it was pretty easy, but during the fall, it's kind of getting slowed down again. Because a lot of them are in college, and I have to work around their schedules. But we're actually kind of speeding it up. Like, I think first one took like a year. The second one took, I think, like 7-8 months. And we're going to try to cut that time in half on this volume we're working on now.
Interesting. Okay. All right. College kids. That's a nice stepping stone for them. It's a good little resume item to have. So I have to ask Dream Projects. Say, like, you had all the money and the staff and the crew in the world. Is there an anime that you would have just died to be, you know, producing and doing a dub on? And you cannot say Cowboy Bebop.
Oh, wow. Kat, we've actually had the discussion at the table, haven't we? If we had anything we could do, what would we do?
We have had this discussion before, and I think we kind of agreed that our dream job would be Sailor Moon.
Yeah.
Because Sailor the dubbing of that was just so crazy. So we would love to.
The word you're looking for is atrocious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love to get a hold of Sailor Moon, get the license to that, and really just have a good time and do a good job with that, unlike the original releases of that here.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Sailor Moon is being held captive under a concrete bunker somewhere, and they will not let anyone at it. But so it sounds like that kind of thing is sort of near and dear to your heart. You guys are really into the sort of, maybe campy sort of over the top kids action shows. It sounds like that's sort of your genre. That's where you sort of fit.
Yeah. We kind of like that stuff. You know, it's over the top. It's a fun show. It's just, you know, just sit down and watch it. And it's just fun to watch. That's kind of what we're aiming for.
And the release decision to do it old school singles with, you know, fine, just, you know, what is it, like 5 episodes per disc you guys are doing?
Yeah, it's 5 episodes of this plus, you know, all the extras. And I've gotten a lot of emails and comments about this as well.
I'm sure you have. But is that just a revenue thing? Is it the only way you can make this work?
It's part of the contract. That's how it has to be done.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Wow, they really wanted you to go old school. Okay.
That's kind of our selling point. Again, we said we were going to do this old school. When we approached them, we used those terms, actually. That's how we were going to do it. And that's what they loved about it.
I'm surprised they didn't ask you to do a VHS release.
Okay. You must don't press laser discs.
Yeah.
Don't tempt them.
All right. Well, I'm kind of out of questions. Justin, you have anything?
Well, I have the big obvious one. How's it doing?
Believe it or not, it's doing well. I mean, I'd love it to be doing a lot better, but again, it's an anime that most people don't know about. And a lot of people that know about are just the mech fans. And we kind of did market it toward the mech fans because a lot of people, when they see it, they just automatically think it's a kid's show. But it's not really a kid's show.
Well, it's a Japanese kid's show for sure.
Yeah. yeah, but it has kind of some adult themes to it, you know, like we put the 13 age on it because, you know, our kids cuss.
Right. Interesting. Well, actually, that sort of begs the question, what is your marketing effort? How do you market this thing? Are you actually buying ads? How are you getting the word out?
Oh, yeah, we take out ads in pretty much all the conventions across the country, and, you know, and we also send screeners and stuff, and we try to get a hold of all like the online retailers. You know, we ask to do ads on their site and stuff, and ask if they'll carry that. And a lot of them have been very, very happy to do it, and we just pretty much buy ads where we can.
Interesting. Yeah, it's tough to market this stuff. Are you approaching it from any creative angle other than just slapping key art on something and putting the title and the MSRP? I mean, are you approaching this, you know, creative in terms of creative marketing? Is there any of that going on?
Oh, let's see. Kat, do you know anything about that? I guess I wish our marketing director was here.
If you don't know.
It's like I kind of have some ideas of what's been talked about. I don't know if it's been done because, you know, the marketing is like all the way on the other side. My job is to make the show.
Right.
You know, and I leave the marketing to the marketing person and they tell me what they need.
Okay. Interesting enough. Just curious.
What were some of the harder lessons production wise as far as like the nuts and bolts of it?
I was putting it together. The translations, those were very fun because a lot of the scripts we got, they're like a fourth to fifth gen copy.
The scripts are essentially a fourth generation photocopy. So a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy of something that was handwritten, you know, like almost, 20 years ago?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So feel sorry for Kat.
The scripts are a nightmare to just look at. Like, half of it's blurred out or scratched out. And some stuff that's in the scripts didn't end up in the show. And they added the scripts are kind of a nightmare.
Just out of curiosity, have you considered just bringing on somebody to just translate the show for you rather than going off the scripts?
Well, what essentially we have is we do have a translator who basically sits down, watches the show, reads the script, and hands us a rough copy. And then I work and I do a tiny bit of translating just to ensure that that what she hands me can't be written any better way, essentially. And then I'll write the final script.
You're the English to English translator.
Yes, essentially.
Interesting.
I know that task well.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, indeed. Try doing it from broken French Canadian. Okay. So, Justin, you have anything else? We want to go to Twitter?
Yeah, let's go to Twitter.
Okay. A couple of Twitter questions for you guys. First from North Star Blog. Are you guys fans of the 90s Yusha anime franchise, the Brave series? And if so, which are your favorites?
I'm trying to think of all the things that are in the... I can't really remember right now. That's a sad thing. I know what he's talking about, but I'm just drawing a blank right now. I apologize to whoever asked that question.
That's okay.
Kat, do you know any of those?
I think I've seen maybe bits and pieces of a couple of them, but I wouldn't really label myself as a fan, for I think that would be a disservice to the true fans. I haven't really seen too much, though, unfortunately.
That's okay. Okay, he wants to know, we touched on this, but he wants to know if the release schedule will speed up for Raijin-O after Volume 2.
yeah, we are definitely do our best to speed it up a lot more. Again, it's been slow starting off because, well, one, Kat's explained what kind of condition the scripts are in, which takes a while. And the fact that the materials, too, it takes a while to get through them as well. And Volume 1 was such a learning curve to Volume 2 that we're hoping now that when we get Volume 3 in the works, we'll be able just to run right through it as quick as we can.
All right. Also from this guy's George Horvath. Are you going to stick to doing only one title at a time, or will your company try to handle multiple titles at once?
Actually, yeah, we'd like to start doing multiple titles besides just one. We're kind of just doing the one right now because that's all we're concentrating on. But then after we get kind of close to finishing this one, we'll work on the other one. And actually, I've actually started talking, trying to find around to actually find some even live action stuff to do while we're working on our anime stuff as well.
Really? What sort of live action stuff?
I can't really go into details on what it is because I'm kind of still in talks with it.
Oh, all right.
I apologize for that.
That's okay. Okay. He wants to know how you guys got Michael Reynolds for the dub of Raijin O. He says, at first I was confused hearing a voice similar to a character from Digimon, and then I was shocked to see it was actually the man himself doing a voice for an upstart company's dub.
Good old Mike Reynolds, yes. He's a great guy, I will say, to work with, and a great personality. Yeah, the way we got Mike was pretty much when we were proposing to do the show. It turned out that the show was an English run a couple years back, or maybe even in the 90s, and they were going to make a run, and when they did an English demo, I guess, to try to sell this, if they ever decided to do it to America, Mike was actually part of that demo. Yeah, and I got the demo, and in the little demo they put together, you know, a lot of actors were in it. I think Mona Marshall was in it, Mike Reynolds, I can't really think offhand who else, but it's pretty much the people of that time, you know, the big stars were pretty much in this demo to market it to America. They just did a demo, and when I got a hold of it, and I'm like, Mike has to play his character, and I heard it, and there Mike was. He was playing the general. So I called, you know, pretty much try to get in contact with people to get in contact with Mike, and they got me in contact with him. And I just said, hey, you remember this show you did? And he's kind of like, oh, kind of, you know. I'm like, well, would you mind doing it now? And he's like, sure. So that's pretty much how easy it was, just picking up the phone.
Okay. Thrilling.
Yeah, doesn't sound too thrilling, but it was actually a lot of fun getting a hold of him. He's a great guy.
Yeah, I'm sure. That's awesome. That's awesome. If you can track these people down and, you know, they get to sort of relive previous roles. So finally, I want to know, did you build a studio? Did you buy studio space? Are you renting studio space? How's that working out?
I built a studio, pretty much, just a small one-room studio. And also the fact that I have other studios in St. Louis that kind of help along as well, like pretty much when it comes to working with the actual footage and stuff. Like, I get the footage, I take it to one studio, I sit down with those guys, we go through it, and then when it's done, it goes to another studio for editing. So we kind of jump from studio to studio working on this stuff. So I pretty much enlist other studios in St. Louis to help me out.
Okay, interesting. Very interesting. Okay, well, that's about all we have. It was pleasant. Thank you for, taking our questions, and thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you for having us on. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us over.
All right, that's our show. I want to thank the folks from Anime Midstream for joining us. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, and we'll see you all next week.